Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are talking about another brilliant result for Aston Villa and ask what happened to last season's treble winners, Manchester City. We'll also be talking about Arsenal, Luton, Crystal Palace, Nottingham Forest, Manchester United and Chelsea. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we've got the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, a former striker who not only played for Aston Villa but has spent the past few weeks saying they're going to reach the top four. Tony Cascarino, what a clever lad you are. And also a former defender who not only began his career at Nottingham Forest, but has spent the last two seasons pretty much that saying you're always worried about Steve Cooper. Maybe you'll finally be proved right. Gregor Robertson is with us as usual. But gentlemen, we've got to start at Villa Park and a 14th home win against the current champions for Unai Emery's side. Never mind top four. Martin, have we got to consider Villa's title contenders, do you think?
I think any team, once you get past that Christmas period, I think any team that is in that mix, there comes a time when you've got to consider them. There came a time when we'd spent all season ignoring Leicester and thinking, oh well, this is you know, they're just going to come back into the pack. And then the first stage is to look at a team and think, well, they could actually finish in the top four. So there was a period when you looked at Leicester and thought, well, this is a potential top four team. And then I think around about the time they beat Manchester City, you looked at them and thought, well, actually, we can't keep ignoring them as title contenders. I think Villa are at stage two of that already.
Right.
Because I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that they are a top four team at the end of the season, come May, that they've qualified for the Champions League. And the next, let's say, 6 weeks, if you're within three or four points of the top, or, you know, if you are where they are now in January and the points difference isn't 12 points or 10 points or whatever, then you're title contenders, by the end of January, I think. And they're good. And you look at Unai Emery, what a good manager. He's always looked a good manager, apart from at one place, which was Arsenal, towards the end. And you do wonder if he'd have got the support maybe that Arteta has got, has had, whether he might have been able to do something like that with Arsenal as well. Because when he left, and I was among those that were very sceptical about what he said when he left, about, oh, I didn't get this and I didn't get that. And you're thinking, well, say it at the time, mate, cut up rough at the time, not after it's all gone wrong. But he left with a long list of accusations, would be the wrong word, because he's a very mild-mannered guy, but he left with a bit of a gripe list of, well, I asked for this, but I got this, and I asked for that, but I got someone else instead. And you think, well, maybe if they'd listened to him a bit more at Arsenal, everything that everyone's so excited about with Mikel Arteta might have happened a few years earlier. The man's a good manager.
Yeah, Tony,
the man's a very good manager.
You've said Villa are going to finish above Tottenham and other teams when it comes to that top four. What do you think about the idea of them being title contenders as well?
Well, as Martin touched on there, the Leicester example is a great one, because they did go toe-to-toe, and Jose's last game was when they lost at Leicester. And I remember that night thinking, ooh, they really beat Chelsea up. And they went toe-to-toe with everybody in the early part of the season. Second part of the season, they went more clean sheets, a bit more defensive, and got over the line. They didn't lose Danny Drinkwater. I know that sounds incredible, because Danny Drinkwater seems like he's anonymous now. They didn't lose Mahrez, and they didn't lose Vardy. Now, I would go McGinn. Can't lose McGinn. Can't lose Ollie Watkins, obviously. The third one, I'm not so sure. It could be a number
Konsa,
of players.
Konsa, maybe.
Konsa, well, he's been brilliant. But
Douglas
there's
Luiz, I think, has been fantastic.
Yeah, he's been brilliant at that role. You know. So there's a few there. What excites me about Villa, and I watched the game early this morning because I saw the goals, but I knew we'd talk about Villa because I was watching Sheffield versus Liverpool last night, and was that they're defending on the halfway line against the quickest or one of the quickest footballers in world football. Well, I hate going back in time, but I will do because we played Kevin Moran and Mick McCarthy as two centre-halves who sat on that halfway line and literally everybody was in front to press and get it and win. Now, this beaten 1-0 and we could go, oh, well, you know, City had enough chances. They, you know, they didn't take their chances. That wasn't that last night.
Mm.
This was a pounding. They were wobbling for a long time in the game, City. They were wobbling. You could see it. Now, I think their success has come at a consequence of, and it's something we could all look at and go, there's about 8 to 10 teams now that will all play on the front foot. Whether it's Bournemouth, whether it's Gary O'Neill's Wolverhampton Wanderers, whether it's Eddie Howe's Newcastle, whether it's Tottenham, Arsenal, Liverpool, Villa. You can go on. There's a lot of teams who are playing high-risk football, but all in the opposition's half.
Mm.
And City were... I mean, look, I didn't like the midfield of City last night. I was thinking the game, has Calvin Phillips not in this team? Why? What has he done wrong, or what has he not done that we don't know? Because to see a Kanji in there, he's nowhere near a Rodri.
No.
Not even close. He's a centre-half who cannot step into midfield, what John Stones
does. I want to come back to City in a minute, but just because it's an excellent point, but just to finish on Villa, Gregor, Charlotte Dunker in her match report talked about some of the things that the chaps have already said, you know, says that Villa showed silk and steel to beat City. What is it that you think that Unai Emery does best? Is it that he kind of neutralises opponents first and then beats them? Or is it that actually they should be seen as a team that dominates, even teams like City?
I would say it's the variety of their play, actually. I think they're so, you know, tactically intelligent. The way, you know, as Tony said, they're pressing high. I think they won the ball 13 times in City's third last night. But then they also... You wouldn't say that that's all they do. They can often sit in a kind of a mid block or a low block, and you know pick the moments to go and press, and then they're lightning on the break as well, and then they can also you see them play it from the back and like play really incisive passes, often through the centre of the pitch. You know the fullbacks will go high and wide, but it's kind of stretch and play, and then they try and play really incisive passes through the pitch and really direct. So I think it's the variety. I think, and that makes them quite a tough proposition for any team. And you know, Hamza's piece during the week about the high defensive line. It's remarkable to watch as well. So when you know,
you've said it's given you jitters in the past, though, as a former defender.
You watch them, and then you so many times you just think you watch them running back, and you're thinking, is an offside flag going to come? Is it going to come? Is it going to come? They must be as well. But then. The number of times as well, Ezri Konsa, Matty Cash, who are lightning quick, can make those recovery runs and make tackles. It's really, really, you know, high risk strategy, but they're good at it and they're so well drilled. I don't know. I would advise anyone to read that piece that Hamza wrote on the website. And there's a couple of pictures in it which are just extraordinary pictures, extraordinary images, because you see, you know, a line of Villa players in exactly the same body shape, all. You know, playing the offside line, preparing to move backwards, you know, weight on one foot, looking at the ball. It's an amazing image, and that just kind of underlines that in that one image, the sort of detail and work that Emery does in training and sort of drilling them. And we're seeing the evidence of it now.
Should they be considered in the same way and light that we're viewing Tottenham and Ange Postecoglou this season as a kind of exciting breath of fresh air, everyone's favourite other team? A Villa on that level, actually, and that maybe Emery's done a bit more quieter job, and now we're realising how good they are.
Yeah, look, people from outside London say that London managers and London clubs get a disproportionate sort of shout because the media is largely based in London, and I can understand that because there has been an awful lot of fuss made about Postecoglou at Tottenham, and understandably so. I do understand that. A lot less made about Aston Villa because they're in a part of the country that traditionally isn't very fashionable for football. It was at one stage, but it isn't so much now. And there's a lot of focus in the Northwest. There's a lot of focus in London. So something good that's happening in the Midlands tends to go a little bit under the radar. Like their music in the 1960s. have a look at the bands that came out of Birmingham in the 1960s.
Yeah,
great bands. Great bands came out. The Move and people like, great bands came out of Birmingham. But you never hear about the Birmingham scene or anything in the 1960s, but there were great bands coming out of Birmingham.
See, one of my biggest regrets in my career was leaving Villa.
Really?
I was really gutted when I left Villa. I loved it as a club. It was a great football club. And obviously, I knew a lot of the players that won the European Cup because they lived, a couple of them, Tony Morley lived around the corner from me, so did Gordon Cowans. And I know that club so well, even though I was there, 18 months, and it's a rocking, honestly, go there, it's rocking when it's on Villa Park.
Yeah. It's a great
atmosphere. Now, wouldn't it be incredible if Unai Emery was to win the league and Arteta came second?
There's an idea.
Do you know what I mean? It's sort of, I spoke to Andy Townsend yesterday, obviously Captain Villa, is my old teammate I've known for a long time, and he said he interviewed John McGinn earlier in the week. And he said John McGinn was saying to him, you need to try the fat chamber, Andy. And Andy's gone, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, like the old days, you get on the scales. We'd all get on the scales and we'd be tested to see where we were. He said, now you go into this chamber and it just basically checks your body fat. To tell it. And he said, you've got to be super fit. You can't do nothing wrong because it gets everything that you've done in it. And he said, and Andy's, well, I'm not sure I want to play in this era.
I'm not surprised.
But, you know, the sort of, and he said, you could feel, not only is John McGinn a great lad, obviously, because at the club, he said, but he also spoke so highly of people around the club that they've got in place, which is clear. You know, there is, Unai Emery's a really strange manager because I wasn't so much critical of the way the Arsenal panned out for him. He was only sacked because of one scenario at PSG. That was winning 4-0 against Barcelona and losing 6-1 away. That's the only reason he lost that job. But PSG sacked everybody that gets eliminated from the Champions League.
I mean, we were dangerously close to talking about John McGinn's bum then, so I'm going to have to...
He used it very well again last night. He did the way he pivots with the ball.
He's off.
He brings it in and he spins. It's like, I know I was joking about it last time.
You weren't joking about it.
Weapon.
You talked about it for about 4 minutes.
And McGinn was outstanding again. Yeah. He was absolutely outstanding. He's someone who's been really elevated.
It's a mismatch in midfield though, wasn't it, Gregor?
Yeah, so that brings me back to the point. We're talking about John McGinn and his bum. Let's move on to the midfield debates around Manchester City because, Tony, you brought up Calvin Phillips and the kind of team. Would you go back to your point because I interrupted you earlier about that setup and how it's wrong.
Well, you know, when you see Rodri's not in the lineup, you're thinking, well, Calvin Phillips has to step in at this moment. And yes, John Stone's available and he can come into midfield. And then you think, well, I can immediately thought, is it? Because he's so far down the pecking order now, isn't he, Calvin Phillips? If he can't get him, Rico Lewis is in front of him. Akanji's never a midfielder for me. He does a reasonable job as a centre-half. He doesn't do what John Stones does. And I just thought the mismatch in midfield, it was John McGinn and others, Louise, were having a field day. And they were brilliant because their energy was just... They overrun that area of the pitch. And it denied City anything going forward. You know, what was their last shot in the 11th minute? Was it Man City's last shot in the game in the 11th
shot
minute?
Shot counts 22-2. It's extraordinary.
22-2.
Yeah. And I think the last shot of the game for City was in the 11th minute.
The thing with Villa as well is that they almost always have four midfielders playing narrow in midfield, which is unusual. And it's not, you know, so even if you look at the way the team's lined up, if it's a 4-4-2, the two wide ones are usually playing sort of slightly advanced and inside, almost as like number 10s, but they roam a bit. And the fullbacks, he has different ways of like working.
Is that why Pep maybe went with that midfield choice of essentially a bunch of defenders in midfield because he was worried about Villa's power?
I think it could have been, yeah. I mean, like, Kamara and Luiz are always the ones that sort of sit, and then if you've got Tielemans in, it would be McGinn kind of creating that overload, and then often they have Digne pushing high wide, and if Cash is playing, he's high and wide, so they when they're in possession they usually have three at the back, cause like a lot of teams now, and they try and create overloads, but the overloads in midfield are not many teams have been able to get, you know, to work out how to deal with it really, because as I say, a lot of the time it's about any little spaces they're playing a really incisive pass between the lines, and then they're on the turn, and that's usually McGinn or, you know, if Tielemans in this game, sometimes it's, if Drury's playing, it's him dropping in. But it didn't work for City last night either. I think, you know, very rarely you would say that Pep was sort of it's wrong to say, you know, tactically outthought, but Villa's game plan absolutely worked and City couldn't deal with it.
Martin, on City, on Monday's show, we were talking about a kind of run of games that had been a bit worrying for Pep Guardiola, and Charlotte was saying that the Manchester press pack had been saying, this is some of the worst performances for a long time. Is there something wrong? Is there something going wrong at City? Or are we just going to come back to saying, oh, well, they've not got Kevin De Bruyne?
No, it's more than that. They haven't got Gundogan as well, who was hugely influential for them last season. They haven't got Riyad Mahrez, who people thought was on the periphery, but if you look at how many games he started last season, you know, he starts as many as Jack Grealish or whatever, and he alternated, you know, with these forward line, it gives them this variety. And they've got Doku in instead, and Foden in a different role, and they're still a fabulous team. But I'm inclined to agree with something that Pep Guardiola said in the week, when he was very much, you know, sort of quite defensive, and surprisingly so, as if he cares what anyone thinks about his team. But he obviously does, and sort of hit back at people who are saying that they were perhaps complacent or whatever. But the point he makes is a genuine one. There is a reason why no team has ever won the league more than three times in succession. And it's because it's very, very hard. Now, we can argue on the difference. You know, some people say, oh, it's very hard because players get complacent. But you could equally argue it's very hard because it's absolutely exhausting to perform at that level for four consecutive seasons, to be the best team for four seasons. There's a reason it's never happened in our league. And you go back to the last century and the century before that. No one's ever done it more than three times. Teams do it three times and that's it. Plus, it's a treble-winning season as well. So that's exhausting. Then they lose players. They haven't got that bigger squad. This thing of, oh, Man City, buy everyone or whatever. Well, actually, if you look at Manchester City's squad, you get to a certain level when it's all quality, 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 and then it's young kids, basically.
Do you think, I remember reading Roy Keane's book and him talking about Manchester United after they had won their treble and his feelings about some of the squad dipping a little in terms of their intensity. Do we think we can level any of those accusations at City players?
Well, I'm not sure you can level them at Manchester United. They won the league. They won it by 18 points that season.
Well, Roy Keane
did. It's quite incredible. That shows you something about that Manchester United team, because after they won the treble, they didn't win the Champions League the following season, but they won the league by 18 points. It was a record. It was a record points difference.
But do you think any City players are dipping a treble hangover a little?
What, in terms of not wanting to put it in? I don't know whether they think it's almost like a mentality where they caught Arsenal from such a long way back last year. You do wonder whether there's that sort of feeling that you don't quite have to kick in, that you can ease yourself into the season. Look, it's going to come right. We'll go on a run of 25 winning matches and then we'll just gradually claw everyone back in. The problem they've got is they're not just chasing one team anymore.
Yeah.
Even if we are cynical about Aston Villa and say, oh, well, maybe Aston Villa won't be able to sustain it. Okay, well, let's park that for 1 second. You've still got Arsenal. Okay, well, we caught Arsenal last year when it came to it. You've got Liverpool. Now, that's a manager that's done it. Mo Salah's done it. Trent's done it. Virgil van Dijk's done it. I know there's a lot of new players in there as well, but that is a club that has won the Premier League very, very recently. You know, and now you've got to rely on two teams stuffing up in that final stretch, not just one. You know, you'd look at the league table if you were Manchester City and think, We've got our work cut out already. We've got our work cut out. We've got to claw Arsenal. We've got to rein Arsenal in. We've got to rein Liverpool in, and that's before any wild cards that might be coming in on your shoulders.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I mean.
Well,
they lost two of the final 23 games last season. The 23 games.
See, they've just listened to Gregor on the podcast.
I always start from the viewpoint of they make you look silly every year. when we have this conversation.
But having said that,
there is something feels a little bit different this year, and I agree with Martin. What is they're not a team full of kind of serial winners who've experienced this already. There still are some, but they've lost some that were part of that group that did it year after year.
Didn't know how to lose. Yeah.
Something's changed in that way.
You said there about players. I mean, the ones that have not played nowhere near as well as last year is Akanji. He's not been nowhere near as good. And Diaz. Diaz has been way off it. Mm. Guardiola has come in at left back and has found it tricky. Mm. You know, you'd think Nathan Aki would probably be their best option at left back. Midfield, they've had Rodri missing for a number of games, which
and
comes
never
a bit
the same
bright.
Team whenever Rodri's
no,
not missing.
Never the same. Rodri is the heartbeat of their team, as in for what he does off the ball and winning the ball back for the side. And obviously, I mean, it's so obvious that Kevin De Bruyne just absolutely can take things apart on the opposition. Like watching last night's game, you'd think Kevin De Bruyne could, in one moment, just hurt Villa. Mm. You know, by one ball. You know, and Haaland benefited enormously from watching Haaland last night. After 11 minutes, when he had his final chance, that was it. I mean, they'd done a, I say I'd done a number, but they could never get the forwards of the ball to Foden or Haaland, Alvarez as well. You know, like they just didn't get the ball because they couldn't get it in midfield, and it was just that. If we're looking at numbers, we always say possession is always going to be dominated by City.
Yeah.
Last night. That's the one thing. It wasn't dominated by City. And if it was, when they had it, it was in areas that never Villa even tried to get it back off them.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see Manchester City away at Luton this weekend. And Luton, of course, getting a bit of a reputation for giving the big sides a bit of a run for their money at Kenilworth Road. They did it this week against Arsenal. But Arsenal and Mikel Arteta, not only top of the tables, but still finding ways to win. I obviously mentioned on Monday's show that we quietly keep talking about Arsenal still being top of the table. And Alex, who's a listener, got in touch to say, I think they're going to win it this season. So maybe the confidence is high. I've only got one question, actually, on Arsenal. Is Declan Rice going to be the first footballer to cost £1 million or more and be considered a bargain?
£100 million.
It's a bargain at a million.
We're going back to Gerard Francis days.
Yeah. He's very good at a million, but he's even better
Steve
at 100
Daly.
Million.
Yeah. I remember him.
Yeah, it was Steve Daly. Yeah, million. I remember. Wolves and Man City. There's a GoFundMe page, isn't there? It's set up by Arsenal fans to pay West Ham what they actually should have got for Declan Rice, you know, which I think is quite amusing. I'm not sure many West Ham fans will think that's quite amusing. He's so much better than the other two £100 million players in central midfield are looking at the moment. In terms of Caicedo and Fernandes at Chelsea, you look at Declan Rice and think, well, he's worth whatever they paid the two of them put together because of what the man is doing for Arsenal. He scored two goals in the last minute, hasn't he, to win games for them, which is above and beyond what is it, you know, what you'd expect him to do. Because if you look at West Ham, in a strange way, West Ham have benefited from Thomas Suchek going into the forward position that Declan Rice was trying to play more of last season, but not scoring the level of goals that Thomas Suchek will get for you. So it you know, that shows you the benefit of being in a better team, basically, that he now is scoring goals more. But it is a tremendous signing. If Arsenal win the league, it's because they signed Declan Rice.
Do you think it's the physical attributes that he brings, his actual performance as a footballer, or is it more his mentality as a player and his leadership?
I think it's both.
I think it's both. I mean, he's a good footballer, but he's strong mentally.
Yeah,
well.
He's like he drags a team forward. He grabs a game by the scruff of the neck, all those kind of cliches. But it's true. It's like it's not necessarily always the tangible things like a last-minute winner like that. It's just his nature and what the effect that has on the team. He's someone that lifts everyone around him.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's priceless.
How interesting do we think it is, that idea? Because he was highly rated for a long time, and Martin, obviously, you're a West Ham fan. But that growth that he did at West Ham and becoming captain and then winning the Conference League, now we're talking about these traits as personality strengths. Mm. How important is that we think about, you know, young players? Because sometimes they move too early.
Yeah.
Sometimes they move at the wrong time.
Everyone at West Ham knew what they had in Declan Rice. You know, there is not a single person that was watching West Ham that didn't think that he was this player, that this is what he could bring to another team. I always wondered about him being a £100 million player simply because you don't see too many £100 million midfield players who don't score goals. Mm. Until this summer, when suddenly there's loads of £100 million players that don't score goals, which is quite strange. But I always thought, you know, that could be an issue because I think Declan wanted to be a £100 million player, and I think that was partly why he wanted to play further forward last season, because he could see that was the way for him to get this top move. But he was a fantastic captain for West Ham. He was one of those guys that always stood up, whatever the performance was like, always came in afterwards, always fronted up. Even his, even the way he spoke after the Conference League final, he was given ample opportunity to say, well, that's my farewell game or whatever. Didn't say it. Mm. Didn't say it. Let everyone have the night, you know, and him as well. It's actually the owner the following day who is the first one to say, well, yeah, Declan Rice is on his, you know, Declan Rice is on his way. Declan doesn't say it.
Yeah.
I remember writing a piece a few years back about I was championing Calvin Phillips being included in the England squad when he was playing in the Championship for Leeds. And I spoke a lot, I compared him a little bit disparagingly to, like, spoke a little bit disparagingly of Rice and saying, like, no, who are you going to include instead, Rice? I didn't see this. Like, I saw that he was, you know, a really talented footballer. I saw that, but, you know, for the kind of player that England were looking for too, you know, still they're longing for this sort of controlling maestro midfielder. And he's not that. But in the same way I speak about Jude Bellingham, the word I always use is the impact he has on a game. It's the same. His impact on a game is unrivalled by most players in the Premier League.
Yeah. Do we think his impact in terms of that personality is bringing, you know, I'm thinking about players like Ødegaard maybe, who've gone through that season last year where they'll have left it feeling, oh, was that a missed opportunity? You know, we've just been talking about Manchester City and Martin, you, Liverpool, players who have done it.
Yeah.
Does it lift your other players who, you know, your Ødegaards maybe, who are incredibly talented but have maybe got that little bit of doubt in you? Tony, do you think having a Rice character is lifting the other players as well?
Well, I think it's unbelievable signing if you're talking about personality, like the boys have talked about. You know, he reminds me of McGrath. Mm. We've all watched McGrath. McGrath, an unbelievable athlete, quicker than people thought, incredible strength, simple things, easy for McGrath, never complicated his game. Declan doesn't complicate his game. Had the ability in the air to get on things sometimes and chip in with goals. Didn't get the numbers like Declan, you know, has been accused of, not getting a high ratio every year. McGrath didn't. But McGrath, if you ask anyone, you ask Brian Robson, the hardest player to play against, he'd tell you, Paul McGrath.
Yeah.
And Declan's got all them qualities, but Paul didn't have the personality of Declan. He was quite a flawed guy off the field, where Declan clearly, I like the way he went about the business of going to Arsenal. He never ever once last season did you go, do you know what, he's on his holiday, he's a West Ham, he's going to see out the season and just go, thank you very much. He was determined to win the European trophy with his teammates. Every game I watched him, he wasn't worried about getting injured, he was given the absolute commitment, and that says a lot about him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and choosing Arsenal, you know, when you're that good, Liverpool would have wanted him, Chelsea probably would have wanted him, City probably would have wanted him. You know, anybody that could afford him at that time, European clubs as well, everybody in the world wanted Roy Keane at one particular time. He isn't far off of that, Declan Rice, from last summer, you know, and watching him go to Arsenal. So, to me, impressed in every way about him.
I think, and this is impossible to quantify, this next statement is impossible to quantify, but I would say there's two or three teams that had the opportunity to sell, to buy Declan Rice. If those teams had bought Declan Rice, I think they would be at least two places higher, at least two places higher than they are now, and maybe more. Manchester United would not be where they are now if Declan Rice had been in central midfield. If Chelsea bought Rice instead of Caicedo, they would be at least two places higher than they are now, because he would have made the difference in matches. I'm not just talking about goal scoring. I'm supporting the point that Gregor was making, that Tony was making, that his personality would be different. That Manchester United-Chelsea game last night, which I watched, you look at Caicedo in the middle there, and, well, he's half the player that Moyes looks at the moment.
Yeah, well, in that regard,
he is a bit of a throwback. They're not many of these people around. Yeah. Mm. Not many players now that you look at, and they have that effect on their teammates.
Yeah, well, Declan Rice having a massive impact at the top of the table. We're going to finish part one with a chat about a team at the bottom. Gregor, you were at Fulham to watch them win 5-0 against Nottingham Forest. And apologies, Fulham fans, this is going to be a classic case of we're not going to talk about the team who's won 5-0. Gregor, on Monday's show, we were talking about Sheffield United and the first sacking of the season. Do we think the second is close by?
I mean, you wouldn't... it'd be amazing if not, I think, now. That's the stage we're at, because... Look, they have Wolves the weekend, and you know there was a feeling that he probably had to get some kind of result from one of these games. But then after being routed 5-0, he thought it was, you know, the cameras kept cutting to Evangelos Marinakis, the Forest owner in the executive box, and he cut a furious figure for much of the second half, and then stormed out after the fourth goal went in, and. According to a picture on social media, which Fulham's press guys kind of, they verified the image. He apparently chucked his accreditation lanyard in a bush of a garden near Craven Cottage. So he obviously stormed out in a bit of a huff.
It's not a good sign, is it?
No.
Really? If you're a manager, it's not a good sign.
No. But he would have heard Steve Cooper's name being chorused throughout the second half by the away end.
Which is interesting, given what we discussed on Monday with Charlotte about the home fans, who slightly would had turned on him. That's often the case, isn't it? Away fans are the hardcore.
Yeah, although, I mean, I think you could have put that down to frustration from the result too. I think, look, it wasn't a good sign for him, but I still think if you were to take a kind of poll of Forest fans broadly across the board, they would want him to stay. I don't know how long that'll hold, but they still...
Do you think he should, though? Because they have lost 5-0 and then they lost to Everton at home.
They've lost four in a row. They've won 1-11. It's not good. It's not good.
But do you think he should?
Yeah, because I think the same things that have been true of Forest's time in the Premier League are still true today, in that he's never had a settled team. Mm. He's never been allowed to have a settled team. They bought another 13 players in the summer, and that was seen as Forest being sort of...
Prudent.
Know, prudent, yeah, stepping back a little bit this time. And that took their spending to £250 million since they won promotion. Like, the number of players in total to over 40. So, like, he said last night, the one thing, he was completely, you know, this is on me, blame me. He actually said he was embarrassed about the fans serenading him because he felt he didn't deserve it and the players didn't deserve it. And he held his hands up in front of the away end at the end of the game. The one thing he said that kind of pointed to some sort of frustration was, "I've named my fifth captain of the season tonight. Like, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to do that. I want to have a settled team. I don't want to be having to make all these changes all the time. Some of that's to do with injuries. Some of that's to do with, as I say, just a raft of players coming in, many of whom shouldn't be coming in the first place. But last night was pretty shocking in terms of, like, their discipline. They gave the ball away, gifted Fulham possession for the first two goals, and then they fell apart. Mm. And so from that point of view, I think it would be a minor miracle if he's in charge.
Well, as we record this podcast currently, Steve Cooper is still the Nottingham Forest manager, but when you listen to it, he might not be. We're going to end part one there. If you've got any views on how much Declan Rice is worth, whether it's 1 million or 100 million, I'm interested to hear them. Or if you're an Aston Villa fan who just wants to share your delight in their season so far, get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us. We're talking about another manager who could be in trouble next, and Manchester United against Chelsea.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Tony Cascarino, and Gregor Robertson. We ended part one talking about Steve Cooper and Nottingham Forest, and we're going to start this section talking about Crystal Palace and Roy Hodgson. A 2-0 home defeat to Bournemouth. Now, in The Times offices, the sports desk is located next to the business desk, and the business editor is Richard Fletcher, who is a die-hard Crystal Palace fan and a season ticket holder. And so I asked his view on Hodgson and Palace before we came down, and he said as much as he is in the category of loyal Palace fan who remembers the bad times, really bad times, so he kind of sees staying in the Premier League as a good thing, even he can now start to see it might not be the future with Roy Hodgson. He said the atmosphere at last night's game was toxic, there's no excitement, and it might be the younger Palace fans, like his sons, who want to see some change. Martin, Roy Hodgson says the fans are spoilt. Is he right?
You know what I'm going to say here. I think Roy was a little bit spoiled. I think he was a little bit spoiled by last season's fixture list when he took over. Because Pat Vieira had this run of games from hell where he played everybody in the top half of the table, and usually in the top six or seven, and some more than once in that little run. It was a horrendous run of fixtures just before he was removed from the job. And then Roy came in, and if you looked at the fixture list, it was like the clouds parted and birds were chirping and everything burst into colour and bloom and everything, because they didn't play a team worth a carrot.
You still have to beat them.
I'm not saying that. And he got Eze back into
West
the
team.
Last season I would, yeah, most definitely, and probably this season, but I think West Ham were one of the teams that they were about to play. But West Ham weren't in the top half of the table last season. So he brought Eze back, and surprise, surprise, the football gets better. And everything gets better because the opposition has changed. This is a real season. Hmm. You know, this season he's getting the matches that Patrick Vieira had to play, plus he's getting the other matches as well. And surprise, surprise, It's not all, you know, rosy and flowers in bloom and everything. And, you know, Roy is Roy. And Roy has a certain way of playing. And what Tony was talking about earlier, about how many teams play on the front foot. If you are a fan of one of those teams that aren't playing on the front foot, it can look a bit dull, really. I mean, West Ham versus Crystal Palace last Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, that was the short straw.
Mm. Because, I got it.
You got it, absolutely. Everywhere you watch, the goals are flying in, teams are playing high lines, pressing this, you have a go, we'll have a go. Meanwhile, at West Ham versus Crystal Palace, it's tumbleweed.
Yeah.
And if you're, particularly this season, because strangely enough, where there's been this presumption that after about 6 weeks into the season, we all thought we knew the three teams going down. Now, we might be completely wrong, but where there's this presumption that these three teams will go down, I think fans are not happy with, we just want to survive. It's like, look...
You mean we know
we're not going down because these three teams are going down, so let's have a go. Let's have a bit of fun with it. Now, I realise manager and owner, they can't afford to think like that, but fans will think like that.
Yeah.
Fans will, you know, if you're a Crystal Palace fan, you are not going to be happy with just surviving this year, because just surviving is, you know, the bottom. You know, it's what you would expect to do.
But I think that's an interesting point about just surviving and Roy Hodgson, because, and I know Gregor's got his "I told you so" point coming up about how the future. Yeah. But I do think, you know, Richard was saying these things about he remembers the more difficult times for the club, and I wonder whether that, you know, the owners are looking at it and going, well, we can go for a Patrick Vieira, we can go more front foot, and then if it's not working, we'll end up going back to Roy Hodgson. So why don't we stick with Roy Hodgson and stay up? I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Tony, do you think, there's any merit in the idea that, you know, Palace stick as they are going forward.
It's quite lazy, Tom, isn't it?
It is lazy, but it's also safe. It's ensuring you're going to stay in the Premier League.
Well, I've done a piece 2-3 years ago on Crystal Palace. It's like a redundant football club to me. They don't do much in the transfer market. What's their record by? 20-odd million?
Benteke, maybe.
Benteke, 20-odd million? I don't know. They don't do a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always look at Crystal Palace.
But they would say they've not got the money to do a lot.
I might be wrong here, but I feel like Steve Parrish, who runs the club... Oh, well, OK, he's not the owner, but he has a big say in the football club. Mm. He acts like the manager, where he's playing safe as well. I mean, I don't know, is he on a staying-up bonus, Steve Parrish? I don't know.
But is it not responsibility to keep them in the league, though?
Yeah.
Yes, but
that's just an eternal conflict for 12 teams in the Premier League.
Exactly. I was listening to Martin and I thought of Everton, for example, who have in the past 10 years have made lots of yo-yos back and forth between the guy who's going to keep us in the Premier League and the guy who's going to take us to the Champions League.
Steve Parrish is pointing out very eloquently in columns in the Sunday Times, I think, like what it would mean to Palace financially to lose Premier League status. Palace particularly, because they don't have much sort of additional revenue like compared to some other teams in the Premier League. So you can understand, their desire to survive at that level and maintain the, you know, the gravy ship or whatever. But it's not that long ago when Patrick Vieira came in, we were having a very different conversation about Crystal Palace. Mm-hmm. We'd need to remember that. It's not like we're talking about a club that seemed to have a real connection to a part of South London that was quite rare in the sort of globalised Premier League.
And the amount of players they produce.
Exactly. Yeah, like Tyrick Mitchell coming through. You know, although he signed Michael Lucy from somewhere else, Eze from somewhere else, they're from South London. They're from that area. Mm-hmm. They're Wilfred Zaha. There was like, they're players that people could associate with. So, and then, you know, Vieira came in and he represented something new and, you know, more youthful. Like, I understand why they turned away from that, but there's no reason to try to not, for that not to be the goal, because if what we're learning is it always comes back to, if you're just surviving, if survival is your aim, you've got to have something else. You've got to be entertained. You've got to feel some association with the club or with what the style of play or whatever. And that's what Palace lost the moment they went back to Roy Hodgson. They took the survival over everything else. And when it starts to look shaky, then there's going to be trouble.
We've got a generation of football fans that we are trying, and when I say we, like football clubs, football owners and everything, we're trying to get football as if it's a branch of accountancy. And this is I've been making this point for years, and it comes back to financial fair play. It's not meant to be accountancy. It's meant to be for the amusement of the working class of this country. That's the sport. That's the sport. It's meant to amuse the working class of this country. It is not meant to be, all we've come 14th. It's not meant to be, we put our reserve team out in the FA Cup because it's more important for us to creep into 16th place and guarantee another cheque next year rather than try to actually win the FA Cup. You know, it's meant to be for people's amusement. It's in the if you float on the stock market, you'd be in the entertainment section.
Do you think that still applies with modern fans who maybe, as much as, you know, Richard's talked about his sons going, it's as maybe they're obviously wanting to watch Palace, but they're also, by being in the Premier League, they're getting to see Erling Haaland, they're getting to see Kevin De Bruyne.
Well, then that makes the United fans right, doesn't it? Come to see United, you've only come to see United. And I hate that song. You know, I hate the arrogance of that song. But that makes the Manchester United fans right.
I'm wondering whether that is a part to play.
It's meant to be fun.
Yeah.
This is meant to be your Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
Have a bit of fun. Have a go.
Yeah.
Try and win something. Try and get high up the table. The idea, if someone said, you know, this is your X amount for your season ticket. Oh, what are we trying to achieve this year? Well, we're aiming for a steady 16th, and you know, anything else is a bonus.
How many clubs?
Why would you buy that season ticket?
See, can I just make a point here, because I talked earlier on about the way football is played. The laws of the game now are clearly given advantage to attacking teams. Okay, there is no way at the present game. There was a period of time in football you could be solid defensively, give away nothing, the Mourinho style, Conte and others, you couldn't get through them. Your defensive record was so good that that could enable you to have a chance to win the league. No chance in the modern game. The laws of the game with VAR and all the decision-making, you have to be in the opposition's half to get a lot of decisions that inevitably give you chances to score goals. If you're the opposite, you're hanging on in games, and I don't think... This is where I have my problem. I think Roy's been a great manager. I remember doing this, being on stage with him, and he refused to take any question about England. He was really spiky about England, and I found that really weird. It's like... You left the England job like 2 years ago. You know, just give some feedback some of the... refuse, literally cut off the question. Then he was like that with Liverpool. I'm a Liverpool fan, so I remember thinking about Liverpool and the way it ended Liverpool. And he really didn't like questions where his... A bit like his age. If you ask Roy his age, it's like a question you feel like you're insulting him. It's not. It's to me, it's like one thing that Roy is failing on in that thinking is that I don't believe you can win enough points by playing a bland, unentertaining way of playing.
Do you think this season then, to maybe play the counter-argument to your point, Martin, about fans going, well, we know which three are going to go down. Is there then a counter-argument to say, well, let's make sure we just stay in this season? Because if you're saying, Tony, that they're not going to get enough points...
I don't think they'll get relegated. No, I don't.
But so then wait till the end of the season and then say... We'll find the next Patrick Vieira appoint. Is there any merit in that?
Yeah, but why did they give him the job in the summer?
Well, there's no point going back. They've done it now. I'm asking going
well, that's
forward.
That's a valid point. If we're going to do it next summer, then why do it the summer just gone?
Because, to my point earlier, that they were worried that, you'll end up going back to him anyway in March when you've
so
sat...
So is that just an eternal cycle?
It could be. But I'm asking, if you're going to move forward, as you guys are advocating, is there any merit in Hodgson staying longer than...
I'm not saying Hodgson should be sacked. I don't think, very rarely advocate that. It's just that I said at the time there was no logic in apart from survival, in appointing him in the summer. And what they need to be doing is thinking about what comes next.
Is there similar issues here with a manager like David Moyes, Martin, absolutely, for example, at West Ham, where, you know, it's a very different thing, obviously, but it's a similar issue in that fans are looking at it and going, we want a bit more from this.
I wrote about it in the week. I wrote about, you know, because it's Tottenham versus West Ham tonight. This is Thursday morning. It's Tottenham versus West Ham tonight. And I wrote about this juxtaposition of Ange Postecoglou and how enthusiastic everyone is around him, particularly at Tottenham at the moment. And he's on the back of a poor run, I mean, which ended at, with the result at Manchester City. I've never known anyone lose matches and get so much praise as Ange does. And everyone at the Tottenham Stadium will be absolutely all for him this evening. David Moyes, now, if you're a West Ham fan, you win at Tottenham, you don't really care how it happens. I'm not saying everyone's sitting there going, oh, we need to be balancing the ball on our noses when we score. You know, they'll take it whichever way West Ham could get a result. But David Moyes is in the last year of his contract. And all of the shock and surprise that he hasn't yet been offered a new contract at West Ham is invariably from people who aren't fans of West Ham. Who look at it and go, you won your first trophy in 40-odd years. You know, he's got you the top half of the table.
Lost Declan Rice.
Lost Declan Rice and has replaced him very well. What's the fuss about? Whereas if you talk to West Ham fans, you almost get the sense it's like that last Sam Allardyce season where they were never going to sack the man, but it just drifted and drifted and drifted. And at the end, his contract was at an end and they said, thanks very much. You know, fair exchange, no robbery, and, you know, off you go. And you can almost see the same thing happening at West Ham, where at the end of the season, they just say, thanks very much for everything, David. And the fans wouldn't be sitting there going, how have we lost this manager? Now, they might do the following season if they ended up getting relegated or whatever. It would then become, oh, how did we lose this manager? But at the moment, fans can see there's more exciting things going on up the road. That's the whole point I'm trying to make. There's a few teams this season where exciting things are happening. Even Bournemouth, who looked like they couldn't win a game.
Well, I was going to come on
suddenly,
to them.
Suddenly, that guy he's looking like, yeah. Oh, he's actually...
Found their feet.
He was Bielsa's man, wasn't he?
He played under him, yeah.
Yeah, he was Bielsa's guy. And, you know, suddenly, look, Bournemouth are having a go.
Yeah.
This is what also, Brighton and Brentford have done.
But also, if you asked Bournemouth fans when they were on the losing run, who were actually watching all the games, they would say, you know what, we've actually been doing all right. Been a nip and tuck.
Well, I think you said it about 6 weeks ago, yeah, Gregor. Their performances didn't justify the losses that they're having.
Yeah.
So coming on to Bournemouth then, and don't eat Iraola, Tony's right, Gregor, you did say a few weeks ago, and I think it was after they lost 6-1 against Manchester City, and you start going, again, we were looking for where's the first sacking going to be. Since then, they've beaten Newcastle, Sheffield United, drawn with the mighty Aston Villa, and now beaten Palace as well. Is this a kind of reward for some of the things that not only you were talking about, but also the chaps were talking about, where of a style of play, give it time, you get the reward in the end?
Yeah, you don't always get the rewards. That's the risk inherent with this. So, and like, we can still look at their decision to part company with Gary O'Neill, who plays a slightly different... It's not always front foot, but it's really smart football, and we all enjoy watching Wolves now.
Good manager.
You can still think that was a harsh decision, but you see why they made it now. Mm. You see that because of the whole everything we've been discussing, it's about seeing something more, seeing a team that's not just going to try and survive every year, who wants to really compete. And the best way to compete is by playing this kind of football that the best teams in Europe and the elite teams do, and that's a fact. Like, you only appoint some of the guys we've been talking about in a crisis now. No one appoints these guys with an eye on the future. They appoint them for the here and now. But the problem is, the future always comes back round.
Yeah.
See, what's so incredible is that we always look at players and teams have been the best in the Premier League, so strong in many, many ways. But boy, the Premier League standard of manager is extraordinary. The versatility of so many managers that can come into clubs, and you go, whether it's Brentford, whether it's Brighton, whether it's Bournemouth and others, you're seeing this style. I think we're blessed with amazing styles of managers. We're not one-dimensional, which for a long period, pretty much one-dimensional in managers, the type of managers, not now.
Yeah. Mm.
And the thing is, look, if you had 20 teams that wanted to play on the front four, three of them would have to go down at the end of the season. I mean, that's in the end, 17 of them would be better at it than three of them, and those three would go down, and everyone could be trying to play the most wonderful football. It's like, when suddenly everyone discovered that they all ate pasta in Italy before matches and drunk water, and no one went out. There was no equivalent of the...
Smoked cigarettes as well.
Yeah, and there was no, Tuesday nightclub for AC Milan where everyone went out and drunk 42 pints. But nonetheless, there were 18 teams or 20 teams or whatever, 22 I think there was at one stage in Serie A, and... two or three of them had to go down at the end of the season. And they were still eating the pasta and drinking the water, but they weren't good at the old football. But so in the end, that is going to matter, no matter how exciting everyone wants to be. I just think that it's an interesting thing. There's the sort of end of the journey. There's your destination point, which one might argue West Ham got to last season by actually winning a trophy, and then there's the journey, and that was sort of what I was writing about in the week, how happy or otherwise fans are now with the journey, that they almost want the journey. The end is not necessarily the be all and end all. Yeah, we might get the fair.
You hardly ever get to the destination either.
Absolutely. But if you look at Ange, he might win nothing at Tottenham. But they're very happy at the moment just with... At least got knocked out of the one cup they've played in so far, they've got knocked out of. But people are still happy with the journey. Because the football's good and there's a lot of excitement. And even when they get beat 4-1 at home by Chelsea, they still come away feeling good about their football team.
Well, we're talking about journeys and destinations and lots of chat about identity. So it's only right that we finish at Old Trafford and two teams that perhaps are still searching for identity.
Are we allowed to do that? Or will someone phone up and ban the podcast?
Yeah, well, potentially. Who knows? But Manchester United
getting a good win. It's a good win.
It's a good win.
Home win.
But we're going to start with Chelsea, because I want to start with Chelsea, because it feels like, to me, and we've spoken about them on podcasts in the last month or so,
very excited, taking on teams like Manchester City and things. Are they kind of the team that takes a few steps forward and then a big jump backwards, Martin?
At Chelsea?
Yeah.
That last night, and I'm sorry because, you know, it looks as if I'm, you know, trying to sort of do down Manchester United's performance, which was good. It wasn't bad at all. But you have got to look at that in the context of Chelsea. I haven't seen a Chelsea team as bad as that for a long, long time. And I'm really racking my brains. I'm thinking of Graham Potter's time. I'm going back to the end of Roberto Di Matteo.
I thought you were going to say my Chelsea
team. The end of Scolari. Scolari and all of this sort of, all of these managers. I've never seen a good team. So shall we say an elite team? A team with
yeah, so you're saying there's good players and they played really badly.
Pretensions to be a member of a Super League not so long ago. I've never seen a team give the ball away so much. It was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, they couldn't work their way through Manchester United's high press. And when you're talking about high presses, it's not the most foolproof one, as we've seen this season, Manchester United. And Chelsea just kept passing the ball to them all the time. I couldn't understand it. I really couldn't. I was watching it last night, and the amount of times you're just looking at it thinking, what are you doing? I don't know. You know, up until this point, I've been one of those sort of, Pochettino will get this right, he'll get this right, he'll turn this round or whatever. And then suddenly you're looking at them last night and thinking, it's been a few months now. They shouldn't look as bad as that. They really shouldn't look as bad as that.
Tony, how do you respond to that, your former club? And also, you were very excited about the performance against City on this podcast, talking about it. How do you feel about Martin's assessment there?
It's been really their season in a nutshell, because Chelsea haven't done one 90-minute performance in any game.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
They just can't get near a 90-minute performance. Even a 60-minute is at best. They opening game of the season, remember the game like, you know, Liverpool, terrific in the second half, terrible in the first.
Why is that? Is that Pochettino? Is it the
players? I never
focus.
I'm always
fitness.
Their business, which was, I think, it was a good idea of buying a lot of players who were young, obviously potential to a degree. It's a good idea.
That exhalation that you heard there was Gregor Robertson.
Yes, I'm trying to explain what I meant. The idea of bringing in players for certain amounts of money, that their contracts are longer and there is a long-term plan. The problem is you buy way too many of them and then you bring them into a club where the money's been spent already. I mean, some of their ins and outs were a bit hard to understand. And I thought the idea was good, but like some ideas, it can be terrible in practice, can't it?
Yeah.
And that's what it's been. It's just backfired in every shape or form. I don't see... I mean, Reece James has struggled, but he's been injured. He's struggled since his comeback. I mean, I don't see Caldwell as a... I don't see him as a top player. I think he's still not ready to be in a Chelsea back four. Thiago Silva's 39 years old. You know, I think there's a lot of question marks about their midfield. It's a decent midfield. It's not top four midfield. Conor Gallagher, as you said earlier, Caicedo, and then you've got Fernandes. They're all got qualities, but they don't look a good three where they complement each other.
Yeah.
So it's really strange how Chelsea are just like a bit part team to me.
And are they going to have to go through, I mean, we're talking about managers and sackings and things. If this season carries on as it is and they end up in the kind of 8th to 10th bracket, does Poch survive that?
He can't.
You don't think he can?
No, I don't.
I think the way they've bought the club,
the way they've spent and the amount of people they brought in, and they've stripped the club.
Maybe that would surely like cause them to look at themselves instead.
But Gregor, when do people look at themselves? Owners.
Well, maybe when you're sacking your third manager.
No, but how many owners literally go, do you know what? I might have made it, but I don't have to suffer the consequence for this. The club has got a lot wrong. I mean,
Look at their bench, right? Casaldin, Matos, Gilchrist, D'Souza, Eugenio, Petrovic. I know Matson, but he came through the academy. James Broja also came through the academy. Badiashile. Who are these people? Chelsea have spent I sound like a broken record, as I know. They spent £1 billion, and this is what they have.
It's your point, though, Gregor, isn't it? They've spent all of this money shipping out experience and replacing them with a billion pound punt.
With potential,
really. Yeah. Well, I was trying to make that point about potential is it's a good idea to a degree, but you can't do it in such a grand scale.
No.
That's the difference. Mm. That was the point I was trying to make.
Just the fundamental notion that Pochettino has this galaxy of stars that just need to be sort of aligned properly. I just fundamentally disagree with that. I don't think they...
So you think then, to my point, that if they finish 10th at the end of the season, that's probably about fair and he should keep his job?
I mean, it's stretching it a little bit there, but I don't think that this team is good enough to be in the top four.
Mm. So top six?
Yeah, of course Chelsea should be competing for that. And it's not a mile away from an Aston Villa or Brighton or whoever.
They won't be a top six team.
I was just about to say that. Last night, that performance. And it's the first time, I've seen other games with Chelsea where you think, if they could just finish, they wouldn't be a bad team. But last night I was very worried. I mean, for them, because Manchester United are a very random team. We all know that. Mm. You keep thinking, they've turned the corner, they're 2-0 up here, this is fantastic. And then it comes back. But last night, Manchester United didn't look as if they were the team in trouble. Nothing against Manchester United. It's just one of those performances where Chelsea were actually, very poor. You were playing Bournemouth at the weekend, I think. Yeah. They'll probably get more of a game out of Bournemouth.
That'll be almost a better test
is for them to play a Bournemouth team that's actually on the up than Chelsea last night, because Chelsea just kept giving them the ball.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that idea.
I just want to say at one point, I know the club's in trouble, right? Every year, first week of Christmas, every ex-player gets a hamper from Chelsea. I haven't received it this year. And nor has any other player yet.
Oh, I've got yours.
I know the club's in trouble.
We'll get you. We'll cobble together.
What do you normally get?
Hamper. We get a hamper with cheeses and wine and all bits. But every ex-player gets it.
Is it branded? Has it got Chelsea stuff badges on
no,
it?
No, it's only branded other by the shop they get it from.
I can't remember which one.
Mason's.
Any of the other players got it?
Have you spoken to them now?
No one's. I know ex-Chelsea players got it, but I know that they do that every year.
Is there a cut-off? Like once you've not played for them?
Well, I'm still getting it. My last game was in 94.
Well, that's what I mean. Maybe you're approaching the kind of 20.
Well, maybe, but I do know a number of ex-Chelsea players. No hampers have been handed out.
Well, let's move on to whether there'll be any hampers handed out at Manchester United. Let's finish with Manchester United.
And
because I do think there's reasons to be positive. Greg, I remember I was asking challenging questions about who's going to finish in the top four, and you ventured that it might even be Manchester United. And actually, you're not looking too bad for that prediction. They're only 3 points off Manchester City in fourth now. Good couple of performances and good results. As much as I agree with you, Martin, Chelsea were poor. United still created a hell of a lot of chances. They probably could have won 4-5.
McTominay, I think, had six.
Yeah, he could have had a hat-trick, at least. Yeah. Hoyland looked quite bright. Anana made a very good save. Come on. He looked good,
I'm not sure. If
you're not going to be nice about him, I'm going to move on to someone else. Harry Maguire.
I thought Garnacho made his presence felt. I even thought Anthony. I wasn't noticing Hoyland greatly.
No, fair enough. That's fine. I just think he's a good. I think he's a good player who's just shy of a few goals in the league. finishing then, Gregor.
I was just about to speak about XG there. But I'm not going to bother anymore.
Finishing on Harry Maguire. 8 out of 10 in the ratings on the Times website. Another good performance for my best mate.
You
slag off. But
that's great to see.
The recovery continues to be quite impressive, doesn't it, in terms of his career?
Absolutely. I mean, Harry Maguire playing anywhere near as well as Harry Maguire can play is a good thing for Manchester United, as is Luke Shaw's return. Mm. He just looked like there's a bit of balance now in the back four,
which they've missed for a long time.
Absolutely. Mm. So the same is true of Chelsea to an extent. We've talked about they've had a lot of injuries, but everyone has injuries, and if you spent £1 billion, you should imagine that you could be able to cope with them. United are starting to get one or two back, and as you say, Maguire has been important in recent weeks, but 28 shots, 13 on target, that's quite rare for Manchester United of late. And I'm going to mention XG was over 4, which is unheard of. So lots of opportunities, and it probably should have been more.
Yeah.
Do you know, before the game, Chelsea were favourites at Old Trafford?
Oh, were they? What, with the bookies?
They were favourites to win last night.
That would be on the back of Chelsea's performance against Brighton and Man U against Newcastle.
The rest of the season.
No, I know. But this is the thing. You've got two clubs there, haven't you, that are extraordinarily random, both of them. Because we're now talking about Manchester United as, this could be another corner turn.
Yeah.
I would have thought if we'd have all gathered for this podcast on Monday, it would have been, what the hell is wrong with Manchester United?
because of
the Newcastle performance. So
Martins, I called out the manager for his lineup at St James's Park the weekend because he'd made... Reguilon wasn't in the team. He bought him as a loan signing. Amrabat. He then had, obviously, Marcel down the middle. You know... And I remember looking at his team and thinking, he's got Luke Shaw and he's left out Varane, he's left out Lindelof, two centre-halves who are left, you know, and then plays Dalot left back. And I remember thinking, you've got enough players in every position just to select a very trusted side. You've got flair in there anyway. Garnacho can be a flair player for you.
Yeah, totally.
And I was astonished by the lineup at St James's Park from a manager that you could see. If you're an international player like Varane or Lindelof or whoever, and you're sitting there and you're going... I've got a left back in front of me as a centre half. Now, that's only one position. You've probably got Anthony thinking.
But he had played in that position before Luke Shaw, hadn't he?
Yeah, he has. But it's not. It's not. If you're thinking of the mentality of a player, if you're sitting there, it's a bit like we started the conversation with Calvin Phillips. If you're sitting there and you're seeing everybody else in there and you're a natural midfielder or a natural centre half and you're not in the team, you're going to cause problems within the group. And I think he played around a hell of a lot of St James's Park with his lineup. He might say, I had a game against Chelsea in midweek, so I decided to rotate. But I don't buy into that.
No.
They have got... Gregor mentioned Chelsea and not to look at their bench. You look at Man United's bench at the weekend at Newcastle, that is one hell of a bench.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what Manchester United can produce. We're very, very close listeners there to ending with some positives about Manchester United, which there were. There were some. We will see this time next week because next Tuesday they are home to Bayern Munich after the home game against Bournemouth. So if you can get two wins there, I'm sure we'll be incredibly positive about you. Bye. Then Gregor Robertson, Tony Cascarino, Martin Samuel, thank you very, very much for joining me. And thank you too for listening. As I say, we'll be back on Monday when I'm sure, as well as Manchester United, we will definitely be talking about Arsenal against Aston Villa. Thanks for listening.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.